Most people who take mind-altering drugs recreationally are looking for the psychotropic equivalent of a one-night stand. No matter how great it might feel in the moment, they know they'll sober up the next morning and carry on as usual with their regular lives. But maybe there's another way. MDMA, called ecstasy by Gen Xers back in the day and Molly by younger folks, is classified as a Schedule I drug by the Controlled Substances Act. Definitely illegal, but still available on the club scene. But it's not just partiers who are interested these days. A growing number of psychotherapists think MDMA has real potential as a therapeutic aid for treating patients with PTSD, depression, alcohol addiction, and eating disorders. And they're pushing for more research to understand its effects and its potential. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. To be clear, mental health professionals calling for and conducting this research want to use it in highly controlled settings with patients under the care of a trained professional. This is not a DIY situation. But while the research that has been completed is limited, it does seem there might be something to this. Rachel Neuer is a science journalist and was among the inaugural recipients of the Ferris UC Berkeley Psychedelic Journalism Fellowship in 2022. Her new book is called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Rachel, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
You open this book telling us about a woman named Callie who had been professionally really successful as an artist, but had struggled in her personal life after a very tough childhood. How did her MDMA-assisted therapy session play out?
Yeah, so like many people who experience trauma, especially as children, Callie's life had really been shaped by these early experiences. She had tried to push the negative experiences she had as a child down. But she described her life to me as though she had a rubber band wrapped around her waist. And the further she got from these horrible child experiences, the tighter that band felt and threatened to just snap her back. And it was really beginning to interfere in her life. She was lashing out at partners. Her house was like turning into a hoarder's den. She then found MDMA-assisted therapy, and under the guidance of her therapist, she was able to return to what she described as a repressed memory from childhood. And this was when her mom was having a psychotic episode and thought that aliens were coming down to Earth and were going to gobble everybody up. And the only way to escape this plot was for everyone to kill themselves. So her mom began to try to force Callie and her younger sister to drink alcohol so that they would become poisoned with alcohol and the aliens would in turn die. Callie had been so horrified by this experience that she just forced herself to forget it because, you know, someone she loved, her caretaker, her mother, had also tried to kill her. The MDMA allowed her to fully see that experience, to remember it and to process it, and to finally free up the emotional energy that she'd been spending her entire life to just ignore it and keep it in check. So she said that really after MDMA assisted therapy, she was able to see art as a process that can be served for wholeness, for working toward wholeness and good rather than just in service of pain.
So this was just a single session that changed things for her, or was it multiple sessions?
Well, Callie has been doing MDMA-assisted therapy in the underground, I should point out, for a few years now, and she does it a couple times a year. So it was really like this long process for her, and it's one that she describes to me as still happening. So she's basically working her way through all of her childhood memories and traumas to just reprocess them and deal with them. So it's a work in progress, but the particular incident I described was indeed one session with MDMA-assisted therapy.
What is it that happens under the influence of this particular drug that doesn't happen with standard talk therapy or anti-anxiety medications alone?
It's a great question, and it's one that scientists are still working to answer. There is new science, though, from a neuroscience lab at Johns Hopkins. The researcher's name is Gul Dolin, and her findings indicate that under the influence of therapy. So this only happens when someone is undergoing therapy, not say when you're at a rave dancing all night. That's why people don't come out of raves, you know, suddenly having healed their trauma. Anyway, under the guidance of therapy, when someone takes MDMA, their brain reopens something called a critical period. Critical periods are a term neuroscientists have for something that I think many of us intuitively already know, which is that there are these periods of finite malleability for learning, for picking up new habits and skills, usually in childhood, that we all experience. This can be things like learning a language. Think of how easy it is for a child to pick up a language compared to, me, for example. But in the context of MDMA at a therapist's office, the brain reopens what's called a social reward learning critical period. And this basically just allows a person to reevaluate all the memories and habits they've formed around their trauma. PTSD literally rewires the brain. The brain of a person with trauma is different than someone without. So it allows you to go in and do this sort of reevaluation of what actually happened to you, how you're reacting to it, how you see yourself, how you're connected to others, to the world around you. So you're literally able to rewire your brain and form hopefully healthier habits moving forward that allow you to get beyond that trauma.
That sounds extraordinary. We should say that just about everybody you talk to, professionals and patients alike, caution that this is not like a one and done miracle cure.
For
Why
sure.
is it that people who think MDMA therapy has a lot of potential, why are they concerned about the hazards of overstating the effect?
Yeah, I mean, this is a perennial problem with any new medical treatment. It goes through clinical trials and there's these fantastic results. If you look at Prozac, for example, it was going to cure everybody of all sadness ever. I mean, I'm overstating that, but yeah, throughout medical history, results have been overstated and overhyped. So people are just trying to kind of temper those expectations. In the case of psychedelics like MDMA, though, there's so much baggage from the war on drugs and from prohibition. Researchers are also worried about backlash and, these drugs not gaining approval as a result. So they're trying to be really cautious about moving forward. They don't want people to be experimenting on themselves, as you mentioned at the beginning of our talk. These are very, very powerful drugs, and it's not something you just want to do at home without the guidance of a professional.
So we should back up here probably and talk about what this drug actually is. How did the substance known as MDMA come into existence?
So the story begins Christmas Eve in 1912, when the German pharmaceutical company Merck filed a patent for MDMA. And they weren't actually looking for MDMA. They were trying to create a blood clotting agent, and MDMA was just one of the chemical intermediaries along that pathway to get to the agent they were looking for. There's a lot of questions around when people actually discovered that MDMA had psychoactive properties. What we know for sure is that in 1975, a chemist in the Bay Area named Alexander Shulgin, he's famous now for synthesizing like over 200 new psychedelic chemicals and trying them on himself and his friends and taking notes. But anyway, he was teaching at UC Berkeley, and he and one of his students resynthesized MDMA. The next year in 1976, Shulgin tried MDMA himself. He described it at first as a low-calorie martini. It was something he could take with his wife and his friends who weren't partaking, but he could kind of click right into that feeling you get when you're like a little tipsy and chatty and feeling good. But another thing that Shulgin noticed, and this word that kept popping into his head, was window. He felt like MDMA was opening up this window inside of him where he could, see his problems clearly, communicate with them. He wasn't like avoiding mental things that we, are usually things we avoid because they're not very pleasant to think about. So he decided to introduce MDMA to a therapist friend of his, also in San Francisco. Therapist's name was Leo Zeff. Leo Zeff was actually going into retirement, and Shulgin dropped by his office as he was literally packing up his office. And he urged his friend Leo to try this drug. Leo was like, "No, I'm retired. I'm done with this stuff." And Shulgin said, "I'm just going to leave this with you, and let me know if you do try it." A few days later, Shulgin's phone rings. It's Leo, and Leo says, "All right, I'm coming out of retirement. I've got work to do." So Leo wound up becoming sort of a Johnny Appleseed of MDMA. He was known among other therapists as the secret chief, and this was for his role spreading MDMA in the therapeutic community, starting in the Bay Area, then expanding out around the US, and finally even to Europe and elsewhere. And therapists were using MDMA for pretty much any type of psychotherapy you can imagine, from couples therapy to treating trauma to just self-discovery. It was really just an amplifier of any type of psychotherapy. But they purposefully kept quiet about this because they didn't want the same thing to happen to MDMA as it happened to LSD and other psychoactive substances a few years before, which was that they got put on the Controlled Substances Act, strictly banned substances that meant no one could do research on them and certainly no one could give them to patients.
MDMA often gets talked about in the same breath as drugs like LSD and psilocybin from mushrooms, but it's not quite the same as a psychedelic, is it?
Well, the really interesting thing, just to go back to those neuroscience findings of Gould Olin, she actually just had a new paper come out the week before last in the journal Nature. And she's found that the critical period reopening that I described earlier actually happens with MDMA, ketamine, psilocybin, LSD, and ibogaine. And her findings trace this critical period reopening down to the level of DNA transcription, which means that a lot of the other studies that have been done in the past that focused on like receptors in the brain and like this or that chemical were probably looking at too high of a mechanistic level to really get at what's going on. And the fact that all these drugs that she tested, oh, but not cocaine, I might add, have this effect on critical periods and also activate this set of genes. To me, indicates that MDMA is, in fact, a psychedelic, that all of them are ultimately acting at the same really low baseline level of gene transcription. That said, MDMA as a subjective experience is definitely much, much different than something like LSD or psilocybin. You're not going to get these distortions of reality like you would. You're not going to have your ego dissolve. The world isn't going to come apart. It's more of this like loving, connected, good feeling. In fact, I find I have more control on MDMA than I do on, say, alcohol.
So explain that control. It's for people who haven't maybe experimented with a lot of things, it might seem impossible to have your emotions changed and yet feel like your behavior is entirely up to you.
That's a great point. And it is one that's come up a lot over the years. People will say, I expected this to be like, oh, I'm just intoxicated with this drug and it's the drug talking. But then when they actually try it in therapy with a partner or with themselves, for example, they say, oh, wait, I don't think this is the drug. This is just me, and the drug is freeing me up to feel these things that I usually repress because, I'm afraid of somebody judging me, or I'm scared to look at this memory, or I'm, too self-conscious about keeping up this image I've built of myself, of others. So I can say I've never done MDMA-assisted therapy. I've only done it in a recreational setting, and it's kind of like I'm an ideal version of myself. I'm really happy. All my sort of neurotic tendencies and anxieties melt away. I can finally be fully in the moment and just appreciate my friends, fellow humans I'm connected with on the dance floor, myself. I can find forgiveness for like little things I'm obsessing over, like, oh, did I say the wrong thing, or did I, not write that story very well, or whatever it is. So yeah, you are intoxicated for sure, but it's like you are you.
Rachel, MDMA is classified as a Schedule I controlled substance, but it was not actually technically illegal for decades, right? How was it used in research conducted by, of all institutions, the CIA?
Great question. So this is a murky, murky story. I'm sure some listeners have heard of MK Ultra, the CIA's really unethical search for a chemical truth serum. Well, the U.S. Army was also involved in this search, and this was the 1950s, you know, height of the Cold War. The U.S. was afraid that Russia and North Korea were developing chemical weapons, not to kill people, but to control their minds. And the U.S. government decided to also get in on this search. They even took some inspiration from experiments the Nazis had done. So this was not at all ethical, and a lot of it was given to patients or to volunteers, you know, without their consent or their full knowledge of what was happening. In terms of MDMA, what we do know is that it was on the list of chemicals that the U.S. Army was investigating. What we do not know for sure is whether or not MDMA was ever given to a human subject. It was on the list along with a similar and related drug called MDA. But what happened was MDA was given to a patient in Manhattan who had checked himself in for depression after a divorce. And without telling him what these injections were for, doctors said, you know, we're going to also be giving you these injections. They were just essentially experimenting on him. This had nothing to do with treating his depression. And even though he protested, they kept giving him these injections, and they wound up giving him a massive, massive dose of MDA, and it killed him. And because of this death, the Army kind of freaked out and backed up and said, oh gosh, you know, we should do some toxicity tests in animals. So they tried to retroactively do these safety tests in animals. Those were conducted at the University of Michigan. And among the chemicals tested there was MDMA. Whether or not MDMA then made it into a human subject is an open question. I did connect with a doctoral student at the University of Michigan named Nicholas DeNome, who has spent a lot of time looking into this question, has had more success with his Freedom of Information Act request to the government than I have. And he tracked down a document indicating that maybe MDMA was given to patients at Tulane University in New Orleans. But the smoking gun document that would really prove this has never been located. The U.S. government actually says they have lost it, which sounds a little fishy. But, you know, until we actually find that document, we won't know if the government ever did get MDMA to somebody. But I do think it's just really important to acknowledge that it might have been given to someone under duress by the U.S. Army, you know, and this would be the first person known to get MDMA, especially now that we're looking at giving MDMA-assisted therapy to our veterans to help them heal from trauma they've incurred due to their military service.
So you told us a bit about how it feels to be on the drug. What do we know scientifically about how MDMA acts on the brain to produce those effects?
Well, the subjective effects are primarily due to a flood of serotonin. So MDMA mimics the neurotransmitter serotonin, which you can try to kind of think of as a jack of all trades chemical messenger. Serotonin affects mood, sleep, appetite, all sorts of things in the body. So about 80% of the brain's serotonin is released when we take MDMA. There's also a flood of oxytocin, you know, also known as the love hormone, and a number of other neurotransmitters as well. So those neurotransmitters are really what are the explanations for that ecstasy feeling, that euphoria, what ravers call rolling. However, it's important to point out that people who do MDMA assisted therapy for trauma say that this, you know, they say, I don't know why this drug is called ecstasy. This is not ecstatic. This is really hard, painful work. So it really is subjective.
So what happens after the like high, if that's what you want to call it, maybe that's not the ideal term. What happens after that ends? If the formula alters brain chemicals like serotonin by flooding our brains with all that we have, is there a risk of a bad come down after?
It's a great question. So in scientific trials, the clinical studies of MDMA assisted therapy, participants did not report that crash, that post-MDMA crash that some ravers sort of colloquial call, you know, the Monday blues or the midweek blues. You know, that said, I'm not discounting people's experiences saying that, hey, you know, whenever I take MDMA at a club, a few days later, I feel really depressed. That's like very common lore among the raving community. I personally do not experience that. If anything, I'm happier in the days after I take MDMA because I have this like very positive experience that I can use as a touchstone for the rest of the week or the month. But some scientists did conduct a study quite a few years ago. I think it was the year 2001, in which they gave healthy volunteers MDMA. I think it was about 74 people. And around one third of those participants did report a somewhat lowered mood a few days after taking MDMA. So, you know, nobody's really done a lot of research on this. So we don't know why this might happen for some people and not others, but it does seem to be a certain phenomena that does affect some people.
So we'll get to the clinical research that is ongoing to look at the therapeutic effects of this. There are people who think we ought to also be studying how it affects people when they use it recreationally, even if it's illegal because we know it's happening. And that kind of research, there's not much of it, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, recreational users have kind of been the guinea pigs for MDMA and for other illegal drugs, you know, for years now. Recreational users are by far the largest user group. We're talking about millions of people who take MDMA or what's sold to them as MDMA every single year here in the US, in the UK, in Europe, and, you know, even places like China, India. I interviewed someone in Afghanistan, in fact, who knows people who use it there. There's a huge pool of recreational users, but there just isn't much research done on them because the funding's not there. The government is the largest funder of drug research, and they primarily fund research looking at the harms of illegal substances, not things like, you know, who uses the drug, why, what are they getting out of it, how might it harm them, what kind of health and safety risks are they taking or steps are they taking to reduce those risks. There's all kinds of research that could and should be done on that user pool, I think.
People may have heard stories about deaths attributed to MDMA use. What do we know about what might have gone wrong for folks who have died while under the influence?
Yeah, I interviewed a mom who lost her teenage daughter due to an accidental MDMA overdose. So it definitely does happen. That said, it's quite rare to die from taking MDMA. You know, you're talking like one out of a few thousand people. So it's much harder to overdose on MDMA than it is on something like, say, methamphetamine, definitely things like opioids. But it's much easier to overdose on MDMA than it is on LSD or psilocybin, which is virtually impossible to overdose on. In terms of what goes wrong, the primary culprits are actually sort of stemming from prohibition. The first is adulterated drugs. You buy something that you think is MDMA, you know, it's sold to you as ecstasy or Molly, but in fact, it's something much more toxic like bath salts or methamphetamine, and you take too much of it and it gets you that way. Another problem is if you buy drugs off the street, again, because you can't buy them legally, you don't know the concentration. So this is what happened to the daughter of that mother I interviewed. You know, she thought she was taking a normal dose of MDMA, but in fact, it was a dose several times higher than what's safe, and it killed her that way. In terms of people who take actual MDMA, the number one killer is overheating. So MDMA, because it's a amphetamine derivative, it increases your heart rate and your blood pressure, it increases heat production in the body, but at the same time it constricts blood vessels, so you're retaining more heat. So it's really easy to overheat if, say, you're dancing for hours on end without taking a break in a hot nightclub and you're not drinking enough water. Especially in the mid to late 1990s, there was also a spate of deaths attributed to overhydrating. MDMA actually causes the body to retain water. So, you know, if I drank a bunch of water right now, I would just go pee it out. But if I'm on MDMA, I'm going to retain that water. And that can cause sodium levels in your blood to drop, which in turn can cause your brain cells to swell. And that can be deadly. This is especially a problem for premenopausal women because of our hormone levels. Our hormones do things that affect water retention, and sodium potassium pumps in the brain that make this more likely. So a good rule of thumb there is just drink a lot of water before you do MDMA. And then once you're on the drug, only hydrate if you feel thirsty, you know, if you're sweating a lot or if you happen to vomit, to get that moisture back.
So how did MDMA start to emerge as a recreational drug?
So, all these therapists in the late 70s and early 80s were trying to keep MDMA a secret because they knew that, You know, when you're not processing trauma, this is a drug that makes you feel good. And any drug that makes you feel good, people are going to want to do recreationally. And sure enough, that's what happened. You know, some dealers started figuring out that they could sell MDMA. And one dealer in particular, his name was Michael Clegg. He was the head of a group called the Texas Group. They were based in Dallas, and they really emerged as the primary recreational MDMA dealers of the early 1980s before it was criminalized in 1985. And they continued to serve that market until the early 90s when Michael Clegg and several other of his associates were arrested. So, you know, what happened was people would bring MDMA to clubs, they would hand it out, and people just discovered that it creates this incredible feeling of unity and happiness and fun on the dance floor in a way that alcohol doesn't. You know, you don't get that sort of like aggro macho thing that alcohol does. It's more like hugs and loves on the dance floor, and it was something that people really clicked into. After MDMA was scheduled in 1985 in the U.S., it made its way to the Spanish island of Ibiza. And from there, it was picked up by British youths who would come to Ibiza to party during the summer. Some of them brought MDMA back to, you know, the dreary UK, and they wanted to recreate these glory nights of ecstasy that they had experienced in Ibiza. So they began hosting club nights where they would play house music, hand out MDMA, and that ultimately took off in the UK. This is around 1989, and led to the invention of raves, because clubs at the time were closing at like 1 or 2 in the morning, and people are just really getting going on ecstasy at that time. So raves popped up as these illegal parties, you know, in warehouses, under in abandoned airport hangars, wherever, where people could keep the party going. And raves eventually led us to the multi-billion dollar electronic dance music industry. So MDMA is really what we have to thank, or I guess to blame, depending on where you're coming from, for that.
So in the mid-1960s, Rachel, members of Congress were alarmed by all the turning on and tuning in and dropping out happening among young people, and they started to make laws, including the Drug Abuse Control Amendment. When MDMA was specifically outlawed in the late 80s, how had therapists been using it at that time?
So therapists were really using MDMA for like anything you can think of that therapy would be used for, from couples therapy to treating patients who had trauma, just to people who wanted to kind of self-explore and self-discover. There was some early case studies published on that, but as I mentioned before, therapists were really trying to keep quiet about this because they knew that it would be criminalized if it got out.
Was there pushback when suddenly they were not allowed to use this in the context of therapy?
Definitely. So when the DEA announced its intentions to put MDMA on Schedule 1, and Schedule 1 is this the list of strictly forbidden controlled substances like heroin and LSD. They're defined as having no current medical value and also a high potential for abuse. So when the DEA announced its intentions to do that for MDMA in 1985, rather than just sort of fold and go with it, as had largely happened with LSD in 1970, a community of therapists and doctors pushed back. They came together, and we're talking, you know, professors from Harvard, very respected individuals. They came together and put together a court case challenging the DEA and basically arguing that MDMA should be a Schedule 3 substance that would allow them to continue using it in their practices, and it would also permit research to easily move forward on this substance. They actually won that case. The administrative law judge sided with them and said, you know, yes, MDMA should be Schedule 3. It does clearly have medical utility. You know, all of you have testified that it does. But because this was an administrative law court, the DEA didn't have to take that judgment. They only considered it an opinion or a suggestion. So in the end, the DEA just did what it apparently wanted to do all along, and it put MDMA on Schedule 1.
So how have therapists been operating ever since, knowing that this drug is on Schedule 1?
Right. So most therapists just kind of gave up. They said, you know, I'm not going to risk my license working with an illegal substance. You know, MDMA is off the table. I'm not going to use it. There were some, though, that have continued since 1985 to use MDMA illegally under the table, these underground therapists. So, you know, in probably every major city in the US, there are people working with MDMA. A lot of them have come to work with this molecule recently, you know, thanks to all the news about the healing properties MDMA can have when given in conjunction with therapy. But, you know, some of them have been doing this since the molecule was prohibited.
Where are they getting this stuff?
I think it's probably different for everybody. I mean, I'm sure a few of them have chemist friends. You know, they are plugged into the scientific community after all. Some of them, I'm sure, are just getting it from dealers and hopefully testing it. But, you know, the problem with underground therapy is you don't know what you're getting. You know, you have to, first of all, find a therapist on your own and, you know, evaluate them to make sure that they're legitimate, that they're not going to engage in, you know, harmful activities, like they're not going to be a sexual predator, for example, that they're actually good at their jobs and not going to just cause more harm. And also that the substance they're working with is legitimate. So I spoke with a man who did MDMA-assisted therapy underground, and it was an absolute disaster because the therapist he was working with, who was licensed, she accidentally gave him methamphetamine, which is terrible. And it was this horrible, horrible, traumatizing experience for him. So, you know, that's a big risk of this therapy happening underground. You know, there's no controlled source that you can go to get pure MDMA. And you also just have to, you know, literally put your life in the hands of a therapist with no sort of recourse in case something goes wrong.
Rachel, this is so interesting. What makes researchers think MDMA has potential, I guess ironically, to help people who are addicted to other kinds of drugs?
Right. Yeah, that's such an interesting point. So a lot of researchers, when they first hear of this idea, addiction experts, I mean, are like, well, why would you take one substance to combat addiction to another substance? So the reasoning here is that much of what drives and underlies addiction is trauma. People are trying to blank out those harmful memories, to escape from their circumstances, to feel the love and connection that they're being deprived of. And MDMA assisted therapy gets at that trauma. It's a way to overcome trauma. So that's the reasoning there. And there has been a small study conducted in the UK a couple of years ago of MDMA assisted therapy's usefulness in treating alcohol use disorder. And the findings were really, really encouraging. MDMA assisted therapy was much more effective than, you know, the gold standard existing treatments that we have for combating alcoholism. And I got to speak to one of these participants. His name was Dave. And yeah, his alcoholism was driven by really deep trauma. He had witnessed his mother being murdered when he was a child. And since then, he had suffered from these just crippling, excruciating panic attacks. And the only thing he found that could calm him down when he was gripped in, you know, the midst of this terror was just grabbing a bottle of vodka and chugging. And it was getting really bad. You know, he was losing friends, family, his job. And then he tried MDMA assisted therapy. And you know, while it hasn't, you know, magically cured him of this horrible thing he witnessed as a child, it has given him the tools he needs and sort of a touchstone or frame of reference for when he's feeling that anxiety come on, that potential panic. He can calm himself down and self-soothe and sort of return to what he calls his MDMA framework or mind framework to know how to proceed without spiraling.
What is the MAPS study?
So MAPS is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, and MAPS was founded in 1986 by a man named Rick Doblin. Rick was involved in the legal pushback against the DEA that I told you about earlier to keep MDMA from going onto Schedule One. After that case fell apart and MDMA was put on Schedule One, pretty much everybody who was working on the case gave up on MDMA and thought, you know, this just isn't going to be a tool we'll ever be able to use again, except for this guy, Rick Doblin. And he's just, it's just his personality. He's very, very determined and tenacious. he was a kid who was raised on stories around the dinner table of the Holocaust. So he always had this view that, you know, everybody around him at any point could just break out into genocidal mania, and that terrified him. And he spent his whole life wanting to find a way to prevent something like the Holocaust from ever happening again. And in MDMA, he seemed to have found an answer. Here's a drug that makes people feel connected to each other, that increases love, that heals trauma. So he really is a true believer that MDMA can make the world a better place. Rick has just been chugging away at this since 1986. He founded MAPS, a nonprofit organization, to sort of lead that effort. He went and got his PhD from Harvard, and he's been working within the federal framework to try to get this to happen. So, you know, rather than doing everything underground, he's found out how to work the FDA system to, you know, get clinical trials approved and just cut through all of the mountains and mountains of bureaucracy you need to work with a scheduled drug like MDMA and actually move it toward scientific and medical respectability. MAPS has now grown to, you know, hundreds of employees, and it has been the main sponsor of the MDMA-assisted therapy trials for PTSD. And it's primarily done that just through donations. And that's just sort of a testament to Rick's personality and tenacity that that it's come this far.
So we will reiterate for folks who might just be tuning in, you are not suggesting people take MDMA they buy off the street or somewhere else and try and treat their PTSD or their addiction or any other mental health problem. But Rachel, for people listening who might wonder why the drug alone won't fix them, why they can't do this on their own, what happens in professional therapy with MDMA that cannot happen with somebody just taking the stuff in their living room?
Right. Well, I will say that there are a few, you know, scattered case studies of people sort of serendipitously coming to like really profound realizations on the drug, even on the dance floor or in their living room. But that's really not standard. So I'm not saying it never happens, but it's not standard and it's not recommended for sure, because these can be, you know, really painful, scary memories to navigate. And if you don't do so with professional help, you can actually wind up making your trauma worse. I'm sorry, what was the first part of the question?
Oh, just why people should try this at home and
oh,
have
yes.
hopes
okay,
of fixing
great.
What's wrong with them.
Thank you. Yes. So based on the neuroscience research that's come out of Johns Hopkins, really the reason that MDMA seems to be so effective in the therapeutic context is because set and setting are prerequisites for reopening critical periods, which, as a reminder, are just these windows of malleability in the brain that we experience during childhood that help us learn, help us form new habits. So MDMA reopens a key critical period that allows a person with trauma to reevaluate and reassess their trauma and move forward in a more healthy direction. But what those studies also found that's really, really important is that this only happens in the right context. So I will add a caveat that these were mouse studies, but there's a strong reason to believe the findings hold up in people too. So if mice were given MDMA and then they weren't subjected to a series of exercises that reopened this critical period, their critical period remained firmly shut. It only happened in the context of undergoing these specific exercises. And in the drug community, that's referred to set and setting. So the set of your mind, okay, I'm going to go into this therapy to address my trauma, and the setting, I have a therapist here. They're here to guide me. They're here to make sure I stay on task. They're here to hold my hand if things get scary. And the really, really interesting thing about this set and setting prerequisite for reopening critical periods is that some scientists, among them Gould Olin, think that this can be tuned to reopen different critical periods. So if, for example, you give somebody physical therapy instead of talk therapy, might you reopen a critical period for motor learning? And if you did that, could someone, say, who had a stroke recover some of their movement? That's actually a study that Johns Hopkins researchers are hoping to test. So giving stroke patients MDMA and then putting them through occupational therapy and seeing if they can regain a lot of their movement that otherwise wouldn't be possible to regain under the influence of MDMA.
I mean, you mentioned those learning windows. Is it theoretically possible that somebody could go back and take this medication and like really learn calculus for the first time?
Well, if I don't know, if I can learn calculus on MDMA, then like anyone can, but I haven't tried it myself. That is a question though, you know, whether we could use MDMA to, for example, learn a new language with the ease of the child of a child, or like learn to play the flute or do that horrendous calculus.
So, Rachel, where is the FDA right now on MDMA therapy? Is it possible for research to continue in controlled settings, even though therapists aren't supposed to be using this in office settings?
Yeah, for sure. So MAPS, that nonprofit group that Rick Doblin founded, has been working on that problem, you know, literally for decades. And all of the clinical studies that you read about in the news or see in the scientific literature were done with government approval, with MDMA from official sources, you know, very controlled, very, very above board. So research has slowly happened. In terms of approval, there has been the last requirement for MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD is that 2 phase 3 clinical studies get completed. The first of those phase 3 clinical studies was published in 2021. I wrote about it for the New York Times, and the results were really, really good. Something like 2/3 of the participants came out of three sessions of MDMA-assisted therapy without a diagnosis of PTSD. And these were people with severe PTSD who had had it for something like an average of like 16 years, who had tried all the traditional therapies and had had no success. So this was a really stunning and encouraging finding. The second of those required phase 3 studies has been completed. I've heard that the results are just as good. It's undergoing peer review now with positive responses so far. So the next step is to get that study actually published in the scientific literature. Once that's done, MAPS can submit an application to the FDA for new drug approval. And the hope is that by about this time next year, the FDA will approve MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD.
Are there official organizations training mental health providers to do this? Or up to now, have therapists using MDMA kind of under the table in their practices been making up the accompanying therapy as they went along?
Right. Well, both. Definitely there's been people doing it underground who may or may not have sought professional training. You know, again, getting back to our point about the importance of actually having certifications and having this above board. MAPS provides a really, really rigorous training course, and everybody who's participated in the clinical studies for PTSD has undergone that training. And they're continuing to train therapists so that when MDMA is approved for treating PTSD, there's a large cohort of therapists who are just ready to go to administer the therapy. There's also a number of startups around the country and probably in Europe as well that are training therapists to become psychedelic therapists.
Certainly, we have a different view as a society of psychoactive drugs than we did half a century ago, but there is still a stigma attached to these things. Is that changing? Are more people who wouldn't consider taking this, you know, for a night of partying, open to the idea that it might actually help what is upsetting them in their regular lives?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I definitely think that the stigma is lessening. I mean, even in the few years that I have been involved in this subject, I decided to write this book in 2020. Things have changed tremendously just in terms of public awareness of MDMA, especially as a therapeutic agent. You know, like my mom, for example, was not super excited in 2020 when I told her I was interested in working on ecstasy, but now she's quite excited. But again, it's just because you see stories in the New York Times about psychedelic healing. You see centers like UC Berkeley opening that are dedicated specifically to studying the science of psychedelics. The topic is becoming respectable once again. So yeah, I'm really, really encouraged by that. And I think there are people that are considering MDMA-assisted therapy for themselves that wouldn't have before. You know, a lot of the people I interviewed who underwent this therapy, either above or below ground or underground, said that, you know, this wasn't something they would have normally ever considered, but they were just really desperate and had heard good things about it. And yeah, it worked for them.
What sort of future do you imagine for MDMA research?
I think that it's going to become easier and easier for scientists to conduct research using MDMA, which is a great thing, and not just on questions of mental health. There's all sorts of interesting applications MDMA can have for studying consciousness, for studying the evolutionary origins of social behavior. So to that latter point, Gould Olin, the neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins, a few years ago gave octopuses MDMA and found that octopuses, which are more distantly related to humans than dinosaurs are, reacted in a similar way as human beings do to getting MDMA. They became really social and like huggy and like were dancing around their tank. So that points to this really, really ancient origin of sociality rooted in the neurotransmitter serotonin. So there's just all kinds of fascinating, you know, scientific discoveries that I think can be made once MDMA is fully available for researchers to work with.
Rachel Neuer is a science journalist. She was among the inaugural recipients of the Ferris UC Berkeley Psychedelic Journalism Fellowship in 2022. Her new book is called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Rachel, thank you so much for making time to talk about this.
Thank you so much for having me and just for highlighting this subject.
You can find us on Facebook and on Instagram. Just search for KERA Think. If you'd like to be a podcast subscriber, go anywhere you like to get your podcasts. Do a search for KERA Think and sign up. It is free. Or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.